Hi there, and welcome to the Living with SMA podcast. We're here to have conversations about living with spinal muscular atrophy. Throughout this podcast, we will be covering lots of different topics, from preparing for university, getting the most from your personal budget, sex and relationships, and lots more. So we invite different hosts from across the SMA community to come together here. We want to answer your questions, provide you with useful tips and recommendations, and also share personal stories. So please do reach out and connect with us here at the charity SMA UK. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find the podcast useful.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the Living with SMA podcast. In today's episode, we will be discussing the parent's perspective of diagnosis. My name is Suzanne. I'm 28 years old, and I will be talking to my mum, Margaret. This is the first time that we've done something like this before, so I've prepared a few questions to ask my mum, exploring how she felt about the time of my diagnosis, some of the support she received, and the emotional side of things, and what diagnosis was like over 25 years ago. Hello.
Hi there.
This is strange.
Isn't it just?
From one side of a small town to the other side on Zoom.
It's a bit crazy. That's so new.
I know. So we are here to talk about diagnosis. Obviously, I was part of it, but I don't remember it. So we're going to talk it through from the start, really, and about your experience and how you felt, how the people around you felt, and maybe at the end we'll see whether you think diagnosis would be different now to what it was 25 years ago. So what was I like as a baby? Apart from being absolutely gorgeous and cute and funny, all of those things.
As a baby, the only way I could describe you was you were just so good. Everything you did, you know, you were happy, you're content. You seemed to be from a very young age to communicate, and you may be able to make people understand what you wanted. You ate, you slept, there wasn't a lot of crying, and in years looking back in hindsight, is what a lot of mums I've heard over the years have said, but she or he was a good baby. And it's sometimes when you hear people the same say he's a good baby, that's when your heart goes, that should be part of the diagnosis.
Good baby. I've probably made up for some of that whinging in the past few decades.
Well, you still have the same knack of getting what you want.
That's true. Yeah. So what was it like when you realised that there was something wrong? Did a part of you want to just run away from it? What were those initial thoughts like?
At the very start, you had this feeling inside that, yeah, because I was a childminder and because I had your brother Andrew just shortly before, you sort of think, there's something just not right here. But you, as I said, you were a good baby. You were content. You sat up on your own. I could take you back to the exact spot where the reality just hit me. I was out with a friend, she was a fellow childminder, and she was changing the nappy of a wee baby just a few weeks younger than you. And I looked at her and I just thought, there's something very wrong. I could have been physically sick. I had to put a face on it. I had to get home. We were out in the days out with other children. And it was just that point where I thought, yeah, there's something. Then I went through the battle of, why did I think that? As if I was, by thinking it, I was making this whole situation up. Then to say it out loud was, no, I just couldn't do it. If I said this out loud, it would become real. So I kept it to myself for a very, very long time. One day it was this thing where my mouth seemed to work and my brain was saying, don't do it. And my next door neighbour was in, and I said to her, Jean, there's something wrong with Suzanne. And what actually happened shortly after that was you had chicken pox. No, it wasn't chicken pox, it was measles. You had measles. So we put it down for a wee while then that it was measles, that I was, but I knew in my heart that yes, there was something not right. Again, when I said to Jean that day that, yeah, it was that whole thing that what have I done? I couldn't take those words back. It was now starting to become real. But it was only Jean that I told at that stage before I went any further.
Can you remember what Jean said to you?
She said to me, no, she didn't think there was anything wrong. Again, this whole thing about being a good baby came into it. But look at her, she's bright, she's full of life, she's funny, she's eating, what could be wrong? No, there was definitely nothing wrong with you. Then unfortunately, then the measles happened. And it was, I remember Jean's words saying, look, now what were you worrying about? She was just brewing the measles. And I'm thinking, no, it's not that. Deep down, I knew there was something more to it.
And then what was the next stage from that feeling of knowing deep down to actually getting a diagnosis?
The next stage was the health visitor came in to do one of your assessments. And she asked me, is everything okay? And again, I just thought, I could quite easily at that stage say, oh, yes, everything's good. She's meeting this, that, and the other. And I just went, no, it's not. So she then worked with you, and she said she felt too that you were floppy. And we were referred to the paediatric department in the local hospital. And what happened there was the doctor that seen you had been at a conference just the week before. She had never heard of SMA. Well, she had heard of SMA. She had never seen anybody with SMA. She had no experience of it. But she had been at this case study, and this was the case study that they were there. And you were on my knee, and she reached forward and she lifted you below the arms and popped you under her knee and sat and you chatted to you and you responded and everything else. And she knew then, that's what it was. So then we were then referred then to the specialist with the referral that suspicion of spinal muscular atrophy.
And at that point, had you ever heard of SMA before?
No, never. No. Never heard of it.
Can you tell me what it was like in the room that day to hear the words out loud?
You mean when we went to the consultant?
Yeah.
I often say that I couldn't tell you where I was and how I felt last week. I couldn't tell you where I was yesterday. I could take you through every minute of that day. I could tell you what I wore. I could tell you where we sat in the corridor waiting for 3.5 hours for the consultant to come. And we sat outside in a freezing cold ward that was cold. It was closed down and we sat there. She eventually appeared. All I wanted to know was, it wasn't one of these stories that you read in the women's magazines that a baby dies very soon, very quickly. I says, is she going to die? And she said, no. And that was it. After that, that was all I needed to know at that precise moment in time, that you weren't going to die in the next few months. Then I think I settled myself. We started to ask questions, but what those questions were just, I can't remember those questions. I can remember certain things like make sure she goes to school, make sure you keep her with good manners. I mean, I'm thinking manners. And she said, these kids with SMA will lead you a merry song and dance. You will have to keep in front of them. You are going to have to keep in front of them the whole time. And I can understand that now, that SMA kids are a will of their own.
I suppose at the time, though, when you hear about a condition that is muscle wasting, progressive, no treatment, no cure, but to be told to mind manners is probably quite a shock.
It was ridiculous. It just I couldn't understand it. When we did ask questions, she said some children who we see who are diagnosed quite early, it can have so many different outcomes, that she basically tried to lead us to say that was an outcome would depend on the individual. But we didn't want to hear that. We wanted to hear facts of how it was going to affect you, how it was going to affect us. But she couldn't answer those questions because she just didn't know what way this was going to go forward.
Yeah, 28 years ago, there wasn't that knowledge.
No.
Can you remember what the first few days were like after diagnosis? I wonder what it's like to hear a piece of information like that and then go home with so little action to be taken. There was nothing to do.
Yeah, it was Friday afternoon.
Of course.
It was Friday afternoon. The appointment was for 2 o'clock and we didn't see her, I think, to 5. We came home, Granny and Randa was with you and Andrew, and we came home to find out that Andrew had chickenpox. And that was a drama on its own. And Andrew became very poorly. All we had was a piece of paper with spinal muscular atrophy written on that. That's all we had. And two numbers. One was for the muscular dystrophy camp, well, muscular dystrophy something at that time, and the Jennifer Trust. And that was it. What, in a way, we were lucky happened to us was Andrew became quite poorly and we phoned the out-of-hours doctor and the out-of-doctor wasn't going to come out to us. So I threw a wee bit of a wobbler and, as I said, my daughter's been diagnosed with, and I read this diagnosis off the page to him and he says, I'm on my way. So this doctor duly arrived to see Andrew and sorted him out and then with this big medical book below his arm and tried to explain to us what he knew about the condition. There was no internet then, there was no family medical book would ever have had anything like this in it. So we had that doctor that night. He had been in the Royal and he had met other kids with the condition and he was able to tell us a wee bit about it. The beginning of the week came, I tried the muscular dystrophy campaign number and it always went in an answering machine. And I just wasn't brave enough to leave a message in the answering machine. I couldn't get the words to ask. So I kept putting that off and putting it off. So eventually by, I think it was about Thursday or Friday, I spoke to the Jennifer Trust. I spoke to Heather. And Heather just said, don't worry, we're sending an envelope. Our name will be on the outside. Don't open it if you don't want to. I never forget that phone call to Heather. And that's where we went from. The envelope did arrive and we didn't open it for a few days. And then we started to read it. There was an awful lot of scary information on there, which we wished we hadn't read at that time. A lot of more negative information that we possibly needed at that time. That we personally needed, other people can need a lot more.
Can I just provide a little bit of context for listeners who are a little bit younger than us? The Jennifer Trust was the founding charity for SMA, which has now developed and changed into SMA UK. It's been through a few name changes, but that's where that's where it started. Yeah. How did you feel telling people about my diagnosis? I actually don't think this is something I've ever heard, but maybe when you told Granny and Granda or Uncle William, any of those people, what was that conversation like?
I think because there was a time lapse between me getting the first appointment, going for muscle biopsies, remember Granda went with us that day. He was always the one who went to those initial appointments. So they were sort of, my father was very much part of that whole build up, the diagnosis, and not the actual appointment, but the build up, the tests and things. So they knew that something was coming. They lived in a very old fashioned world where they believed in prayer, they believed in things were going to be all right. It was quite difficult to convince them that, no, things aren't going to be, this, not that they're not going to be all right, they're not going to be the same. It's going to be different. And it took a lot of convincing of people. But she's so bright, she's so good. There's nothing wrong. The doctors get it wrong. And it was very much living in the TV magazine type era where doctors get it wrong and she's going to be fine. And I think that was one of the hardest things to deal with. It'll be okay. Everything will be okay. And you just feel like screaming saying, it's not going to be okay. It's going to be very different. But don't try and patronize me that it's going to be okay. It's not. It's going to be different for a while until we get used to a different way of life.
And getting used to a different way of life, what was that? What does that mean?
We were very lucky when I eventually hit base with Una Morrison from MD. She doesn't mind me saying this, but she's a wee bit crazy. And her diagnosis, or her way of saying to us, she says, try and let go of the dream. Let go of the expectations you had of your daughter and how you felt that she was going to, how things were going to be in the future. And let go of that and grieve it and go through the natural process of being sad about that. But learn to focus on what you can do, what you can do. And I think that was very wise words to me way back then, where she allowed us to let go, but yet made us to focus on what was important, and what you could do, what we could do as a family, and the things that we could do as a family, we did it and we enjoyed it. And we didn't think about climbing mountains because we didn't need to climb a mountain. You know, if your brother wanted to climb a mountain, there was lots of ways of getting him up the mountain without us. As I always said, Claire's wasn't up there. You know, Claire's accessories was at the top of that mountain. We would have been at the top of the mountain too, but we didn't need to be, so.
Yeah, it's like you had to kind of redefine things, which I suppose it's very different from my experience because I've never known any different. Yeah. Whereas you maybe imagined that I would become a cheerleader or...
I think that it was that image of a little dress that started below your waist and went straight out and white frilly socks with black patent shoes. And you were wearing those wee shoes and the wee pitter-patter that. I think that was the image that's... is letting that image go and the image change to chasing after you in a wheelchair.
I always love that story of me in Marks and Spencer's in the rails.
Oh yes, but you wouldn't try the dress on.
Yeah, you should maybe tell that one.
Yeah, I think we were invited to a wedding and she there was a lovely little dress that Suzanne decided she didn't like. So she hid, she went in under, in the wheelchair, into those circle rails, in between the clothes, and went in and refused to come out. So I just said, well, just stay there, and walked off and left. And poor Jean again, and she was there. I said, you can't leave her there. And I thought, you can. She'll come out when she's ready. And poor Jean had to go between the two of us to get the dress sort of. But we ended up, no, we agreed the dress wasn't right, so we didn't come home with the dress.
I won. Yeah. Let's hope that my own floor girls this week don't have the same reaction.
Oh, yes. Justice.
Yes, I'm getting married in 6 weeks. So this week we have the trial of the floor girl dresses. So hopefully they don't take after Auntie Suzanne and they're a little bit more compliant with the dress.
Yeah, I often laugh at it now. Suzanne has got this rather big greyhound and she is such a diva. And what I say, you never ever see somebody, an owner and a dog, so similar in that have diva attitude and they have to have it done their way or else there's a major fallout.
So. Yeah. Well, as you've said to me many times, I reap what I sow, that I have now got a very difficult dog to live with. So if we step back a little bit and we were talking about Una, and she gave you that permission to grieve the old image and to move on. But I'm wondering, what other support did you have at that time?
I was the kind of person at the time where it was very much, I didn't want to look in the future. I didn't want to be involved too much with. I hadn't become brave enough to move forward with that. So I must admit, I just kept within my own family, friends at that particular time for the first wee while. It was Una again who persuaded me to go to a family conference with MD. And then there's a few hiccups and we went there, and then there was a few hiccups where your dad and I separated, and we went on holiday to Butlins, and we bumped into a family in Butlins whose daughter has SMA too, and Liz persuaded us to come to conference in England to the Jennifer Trust, which is now SMA UK, and we went the following year to that, and that was where I got my support then. Through families. In those days, it was telephone calls. It was nothing like this, no internet, no Facebook, no instant messages if you needed to speak to somebody. They very quickly put me in contact with a few people in Scotland and a family in England who I was able to ring when I needed them. And Faye and Liz were very, very supportive to me during those first few years of making it real. Liz has a knack of making it all very real, very honest. And it was a few years that there were some honest things that she told me that was a bit, but I learned from them.
And do you think that meeting Faye in that way was good? It was what you needed to get over that hurdle?
Yeah. I think when we went to the MD group thing, it was boys with Duchenne, it was children with forms of MD, which were always slightly different than what you had. And you're always, that's the sort of the mindset, oh, they're that's happening to them, but Suzanne hasn't got that. And it was very much that sort of thing, what we have is different. And but seeing Faye, this is our future, this is what my wee girl is going to be like in whatever, I was about 4 or 5 years older than you. And she is absolutely gorgeous. She still is the most beautiful person. And it gave me, yeah, this will be okay. Like, you know, look at Faye. She's just a normal wee girl running about.
Equally cheeky.
Yeah.
Do you know what you wanted from support? I know that was a very long time ago, but can you identify what you were looking for? Was it that emotional support?
It probably was. I think it was like, after a wee while, I had to do it when I was doing it on my own. You had nobody there that knew exactly how you felt. Where I had some very close friends, and I have a friend who came through it right from the start, and she's still my closest friend, and she's always there. But I couldn't expect her to understand what I was feeling, my despair, my worry, my anxiety, because they still have not understanding. They sit very quick to say, it'll be all right. And that's one of the most frustrating things that you could hear. Where when you got the support then from other families who have the same condition, it gave you knew that when you asked the question, you got an honest answer because they were living the same life as you.
Yeah. Do you think if you received a diagnosis now in 2021, would your experience be different?
Yeah, I think it'd be very different. I don't know whether it would be any better now, because my understanding of what it's like now is that you're told what they suspect and what they're testing for. My worry with that is that you run home and immediately you go on to the scary world of the internet.
Yeah.
You find, oh, it could be this. And you find maybe something that would just send your head on an absolute spin. You're maybe looking at things that you're not going to necessarily need to know, because it might even be diagnosed with that. So to me, now it's scary. The other side of scary too is that you actually speak to somebody who isn't regulated, for a better word, through one of the big charities like SME UK. You know, you just don't have that regulation, and they're on their own agenda, and that can be very, very scary. If you have somebody who's on their own agenda speaks to you on a bad day and puts their burdens onto you,
yeah,
a very scary place to be.
Yeah, because now you can contact someone in any part of the world within minutes, whereas suppose 28 years ago, to speak to somebody else, you had to go via a charity or via an organisation. So it's a lot more uncensored, really, isn't it?
Yeah. But yet then, suppose too, those days as well, it was maybe more censored, because if the charity would sort of vet the people who you spoke to, and if they trained the people who you spoke to and they gave them training, because I know I went through it later on after a wee while, you were guided to take your responses from the person who's asking the questions, and you're actually helped to not take your personal difficulties into that conversation with that person. That was always very important. Where today, yes, there's so much positive things out there. You can immediately look up and see what, if something starts to go wrong, you can look up and find out what it is. You can help deal with it, where you wouldn't have done 28 years ago. And you can get to speak to, as you say, anybody in the world. But again, that's to me very, you don't know who you're talking to. The other side of it is you don't know exactly who that person is. So I'm just old-fashioned now, I'm not kept up with the whole.
I think maybe my opinions are slightly different, because I think that now, if a child is diagnosed with SMA, there's just so much more hope and knowledge. You know, they can start one off a few types of treatments. And I think the generation where it was, they waited until things went wrong. So they waited for a decline in respiratory function or a decline in scoliosis before they actually managed it. And I think that's what's amazing now, that kids are getting treatment preemptive.
Yeah.
And that's brilliant, really.
Yeah, I think that your generation was the generation they learned from.
Yeah.
So, but every generation, the generation before that, that your generation, they realised that there was a lot of people who were getting, like, spinal surgery, for example. They weren't getting spinal surgery until they were really broken. And then they were operating on a very seriously ill person, where when you came along, things start to show, oh, it's going a wee bit wrong here. And not long into that, then they started to prevent that, and they would do spinal surgery, where now it seems to be, but then again, now they have so much technology, the rods grow and
everything. Yeah.
It's the technology of the actual operation, the anesthetics they use has come on tenfold, but what's every generation? And it gives you, somebody like myself, who's been around SMA for 28 years, I've seen quite a few treatments come and go over the years, and but in recent years it has given me such hope to see how much it has moved on, and the treatments and the prevention of things going wrong, getting young children into properly seated chairs and things like that, not letting their backs go wonky and things. Like, it's positive. And also you have the backings of big charities who are a big voice now in health professionals, and they come and they speak to health professionals on your behalf, and they educate.
Yeah.
They get occupational therapists, physios, young nurses and things. There's an opportunity for when a child's diagnosed in an area that person can come into that area and speak to that child's professional group of people and work forward, where we had nothing of that. We were just trial and error.
I remember the long discussions with my paediatric respiratory consultant trying to get me onto nighttime ventilation. And that was a battle, and that was you asking and asking and saying, we know some people in England that are on this, and that's not the way it would be today. I don't know what the medical books say, but I would imagine that non-invasive ventilation is something that is talked about early on.
Oh yeah, I remember the cough assist, he didn't even know what it was.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't know what it was, but that was all going to conferences and things and speaking to me, keeping in contact with different families, and the cough, and I can remember one time being in the hospital with a wee one that was very, very ill, and phoning the Jennifer Trust again. And speaking to somebody, and they're not treating this child properly, and then helping that mum, giving her the information to take forward, and that wee girl came through it, and she did really well after that. You know, it was difficult days constantly fighting to, you know, to be one step ahead of these guys and for them to listen to you, but it just kept going. We just had to keep fighting.
Sounds like as a SMA mum, you always had to be one step ahead. She said that at the very start. Yes. With diagnosis as well, you had to be a step ahead of me, and then a step ahead of the doctors.
Yeah.
Just wonder how many steps ahead you are by now. Are you a few miles or?
I remember one consultant saying to us one time, I'm not giving exactly his words, but he had a young student doctor with him. And what he said was, the only piece of experience or only piece of information I can give you about SMA is never, ever try to
beep
an SMA mum, because they'll take you out. They'll take you down. They are unique on their own. It's true, you know, I do.
Yeah. But if it wasn't for that attitude, we wouldn't be sitting here today doing this. I needed a nippy, I needed a cough assist, I needed spinal surgery. All those things have brought me to where I am today.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you want to say about diagnosis before we finish up?
I think the big advice that I was given away back at the start is do what you can do as a family and do it well. And don't hold on to things that you can't do. There's no point, you know. There's no point thinking about things and the negative things you can't do. There's no point. You're not going to accomplish anything. You're going to take up all necessary energy. Just do what you can do and enjoy it and move forward. And remember, if you're an SMA mom out there, you will need to be two steps ahead. And that's going to somebody who's had 28 years of being two steps ahead. So enjoy life with, you know, it is, yeah.
Look how many members of the royal family you've met through me now.
Yes.
Yeah. We've never climbed a mountain, but...
Have we not?
Have we? Well, there was that time we went up the mountain in Spain and I turned blue.
Yes, oh yeah.
So it wasn't really great.
That's yeah. True. And you've been to the top of the little Scrabble Tower.
Mm. Mm. Not really a lot of desire for that. You've mentioned a few times about Andrew, my brother, and I just wonder what it was like maybe watching Andrew reach all of his milestones and maybe people around me, my own peers, what that was like.
Yeah, I think that was part of it. That was one of the most difficult things, was watching sometimes you being frustrated because you couldn't keep up with your peers. But I think from an early age, I tried my best to get you to go to groups for able-bodied kids or whatever. And I was very lucky. Sometimes I had leaders who would help me, allow you to get into things like that. I remember at times you were quite anxious about it. And the thing that came back to bite me many years later was I used to say, but you'll be okay. You know, there's nobody else's mummy in there, on you go. And but on the other side, we tried to get you involved with other children who were the same as you. So you had that balance of you had that balance between your able-bodied friends and friends in wheelchairs. Unfortunately, the thing with children in wheelchairs and stuff, that it was an area where you very quickly grew out of, where you were wanting to do your own thing, you were wanting to be go, go, go. And some of the leaders were very used with children who didn't have their own minds. So very quickly you became very frustrated with that. And we sort of lost that very quickly. It was difficult sometimes when you I think it was up at the stage where you were not old enough for a wheelchair, which I know now is very different because kids went to wheelchairs very quickly. That stage between you weren't old enough for a wheelchair and you were too big realistically to be in a buggy, that was where the difficult one was, where people would say, why is that big girl up and about walking? And sometimes you try to be very polite and say, oh, she's fine, yeah, and you ignored it. And then sometimes you had to take, just say, no, she doesn't walk. And that's always then ended up in a big awkward situation. But that, I think that transition between once you get into the wheelchair and you started running around and running off from the shopping centre and getting lost and doing all the things that any other child would do, getting in people's way and sitting where, you know, standing in the front of somebody and get out of the person's way. And, you know, all those things that just, it became normal. And it was the wheelchair that really gave us that normality of you running around, for a better word. And that was, and then it gave you the chance to go to your friends' houses. And if they're, and over the years, we've had some very dodgy pieces of ramps and into people's houses and things. You think when you go looking for you, and there's this piece of wood in the garden, the back door, thinking, oh, please don't tell me she's gone up that, knowing you had to come down it. You know, we were very lucky that you had you yourself again had the ability to turn around and say to daddies, just lift me. I can go upstairs. And, you know, and you used to find you places where you really shouldn't have been. But it was difficult. Teenage years then became a wee bit difficult because you weren't like getting into nightclubs and stuff like that. But suppose in a way you were lucky then. You had your big brother, and his crowd used to take you some places and things like that, and had an awful lot of a big group of big brothers and big sisters to look after
That brings back so many scary memories of getting into people's houses whenever I was younger, and then thinking, I don't know how I'm getting out again. Or like as a teenager, I've got into such and such a house, but can you come around? I don't know how I'm going to get out again. It's just the fear, but you always seem to do these things.
Oh, it's not the first time we've had to bring put you on the sofa and bring the wheelchair out first by bed and then go back in for you. But that was but the wee thing I said earlier about, it was brave me sort of saying, "Oh, can't you go? There's nobody else's mummy there." That was brave on you and on me leaving you somewhere where you could get yourself into situations. And that was always a bit we always grew up with things. Oh, you'll be fine. You know where I am, ring me. And it did come back to bite me, that one. It's when you were going to uni and it was our first interview from university. Again, I could take you right to that spot. And we were walking out of the uni and you said to me, "Mom, do you think I can do this?" And I said, my heart said, "Oh, please, don't want you to go." And I said, yes, of course you can. And I just came back and said, "Well, I know where you are if I need you, don't I?" And you did. You went ahead to uni and you spent 3 years in halls and things as well. So,
And then a further 6 grueling years of PhD life,
yes.
which I'm not quite over and ready to talk about yet.
But Dan says that's 6 years you've done it.
Yep, it's done now.
Dr. Glover, very proud. Very proud moment for us all.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our story. Don't forget to subscribe to the Living with SMA podcast. If you do have any questions you would like to ask myself or my mum, please get in contact with us through the SMA UK charity. The charity is on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and the website is smauk.org.uk.